Next, I want to get into some commentary on the book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right by Rabbi Michael Lerner, which is a book that seems to be having a fair amount of influence and is a serious putting forward of a position and a viewpoint and deserves to be engaged seriously. Now, I've spoken to many of the issues raised by Lerner, or closely related issues, in the second part of the book, Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, in commenting on Jim Wallis and his book, The Soul of Politics. But it's worthwhile speaking directly to Lerner's latest book, which is written in the context of the growing power of what he calls the Christian right, and which we identify as the Christian fascists. Now, before getting further into the discussion of his book and into some of the particular questions it addresses, I have to begin by saying that first discussing this concept of the left hand and the right hand of God, and then making a brief observation about that. As Lerner presents it, there's these two traditions within the religious tradition with which he identifies, which is specifically a Judaic one, but more generally the Judeo-Christian one, as it's often called. The left hand of God is the one of compassion, of love, of concern for the poor, of concern for justice. And the right hand of God is the vengeful, wrathful aspect of God, to which whose manifestations, accepting these terms for a moment, left hand, right hand, I've spoken to quite a bit here. But I'm not sure this is a division that we can accept. For example, it would be interesting to put to people like Lerner and others who accept a lot of the mischaracterization and distortions about communism and talk a lot about the horrors committed under Stalin and even under Mao and so on and so forth. I wonder how they would respond if we say, well, all that stuff you're talking about, that's the right hand of Stalin or the right hand of Mao. You're ignoring the left hand. That's the part we want to talk about. All the ways in which land was given to the peasantry and the people's needs were met. We're building our tradition on the left hand of communism. I think these things are more an integral whole than that. Now, having said that, I do want to emphasize that there are things to unite with in Lerner's position. And there are insights of his that we can and should learn from. And I just wanted to begin with, briefly characterize some of this and go into it further as we go along. Throughout this book, he emphasizes the need for, and in this society, the crying lack of larger meaning and purpose in people's lives beyond narrow and selfish economic interests, and what we would identify as an economist approach. The whole approach of reducing everything to people's narrow economic interests as the only real or only legitimate motivating factor in their lives. That this is, as he would present it, and as we would agree to a significant measure, an impoverished vision of human beings and their capabilities. To put it another way, to use the biblical terms, he's emphasizing something in a different way and coming from a different standpoint, but overlapping to some degree, we would agree. Namely, that people cannot live by bread alone. As important as bread is to people, and he does not deny that it's important to them, this is not enough to make for meaningful and fulfilling human existence and human relations. Along with this, there's a very sharp critique in his book of consumerism and what we would call, and he does to some degree, identify as parasitism. The whole way in which there's this great disparity between the size of the U.S. population and the share of the world's resources that are consumed in this country. And he emphasizes the need to struggle against this whole consumerist culture and the idea that besides, you know, narrow economic motivation or along with that, the whole worth of a person should be measured by what they can consume, by the amount of consumer goods they have, and that life should be organized and given meaning around the pursuit of consumer goods, acquisition of more and more commodities. And he emphasizes repeatedly the need to change people's ways of thinking and their motivation in relation to this. He has an extensive argument about, okay, if we went for the kind of world that I'm talking about, which, as I'll get to, is ultimately unrealizable, but that doesn't mean there's nothing to unite with in his vision. He says, okay, if we get to a world like as I'm envisioning it, we wouldn't have such a luxurious life for so many people in this country, but what would be so terrible about that? What if we didn't consume so many things? You know, what if we didn't use so much oil? What if we didn't dominate so much of the technology and use it for narrow purposes? Wouldn't life, after all, be more meaningful anyway? Wouldn't it be a worthwhile trade-off, if you want to use that term? And there's importance to this. It's struggling against the idea that Americans have some sort of inherent right and should pursue a life based on, to a large degree, being a parasite on the rest of the world. Is to a significant measure something in which in the cultural and even ideological realm we can unite with. If you think about restructuring society on the basis of having had a revolution and seizing power, and no longer living off the backs of other people, either exploiting a part of this society or living off the exploitation of people all around the world, which is what in effect U.S. imperialism does and doles out a small portion of that to fairly broad sections in this society, in effect. That ideological struggle over that question, even when waged by someone like Lerner, which is not going to provide the full and right synthesis, can make a contribution, and it's part of the struggle that we need to wage coming from a different standpoint, but overlapping in some measure. Similarly, his emphasis on the corrosive effect of market relations, including selling yourself at work and so on, in effect, the corrosive effect of this on relations generally in society, including personal and family relations, and the way that people are, you know, thrown into competition with each other and see each other as obstacles to, you see others as obstacle to your desires, your objectives and your advancement, and or as things to be not only competed with, but to be used or shoved aside. And that this carries over not only from the, carries over from the realm of work, where it's the prevailing and defining relationship, into all parts of people's relationships, including, again, the most personal ones. So again, there's an aspect of this that's getting at something important. And there are insights in relation to this that, is again, we should learn from. And there are things and things to unite with and ways in which we should be seeking to unite with people like Lerner in the political struggle. If I'm not mistaken, he has, for example, signed the call of World Can't Wait. But there's also an additional dimension in which unity should be sought with people like Lerner. Even while carrying out principled struggle over important and decisive ideological as well as political questions. The following from the conclusion of The Truth About Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer speaks to this in a basic way, emphasizing the need for building a united front culturally and in terms of values as well as politically. It says, "We believe that together with building this political unity and struggle, there is also a need and a basis to forge broad unity among diverse forces around values and cultural expressions that promote and celebrate equality between men and women and between peoples and nations, that stand against oppression and against violence which furthers and enforces such oppression, that opposes imperial domination by one nation over others and military bludgeoning to impose that domination, that fosters relations among people based on an appreciation for diversity but also for community, values and culture that prize cooperation among people in place of cutthroat competition, that put the needs of people above the drive to accumulate wealth, that actually promote the global interests of humanity as opposed to narrow national antagonisms and great power domination." The development of unity around such values and cultural expressions, like the furthering of political unity and struggle, will be an ongoing process. Building this unity is a challenge that must be taken up by all those who recognize the horror of what is represented by the fundamentalist reactionaries and the implications of this for the masses of people, who refuse to accept that the only alternative to this is one which shares essential things in common with it, who recognize the need to confront and to offer a positive alternative to the whole politics of poverty, punishment, and patriarchy, and the ideological rationalizations for this politics. It is a challenge that must be boldly and urgently taken up. But at the same time, it must be stressed that this is one level of unity that needs to be built, and it cannot and must not substitute for boldly bringing forward the larger program and the larger worldview and methodology of communism and the need for revolution, but must be encompassed within, from our standpoint, encompassed within and a part of that. And at the same time, we have to recognize that the limitations and errors in analysis, and even frankly some very bad positions put forward by Lerner, point very strikingly to the need for leadership representing the proletariat and its revolutionary and outlook and interests as a class in the broadest sense, both in order for positive aspects in people like Lerner to be united with correctly and brought forward as fully as possible, and even more fundamentally, in order to really strike to the roots of and uproot and finally abolish the whole ensemble of oppressive and exploitative relations within the U.S. and internationally that Lerner recognizes and opposes in some important ways, but only in part on the basis of his own outlook and present program. So examining not only some of Lerner's political positions, but also his ideological and philosophical viewpoint, helps to underline why it is necessary, in the most fundamental sense, that the program and the outlook and method representing the revolutionary proletariat, again in the broadest sense, the communist viewpoint and communist objectives, come to the forefront and in an overall sense and ultimate sense lead in the overall struggle against injustice and oppression. Now, I've spoken to how Lerner talks about the, in some ways, penetratingly and insightfully to the effect of the capitalist market, which he sometimes calls it, the capitalist market, and how this carries over into all spheres of people's relations, including the most intimate and personal. And I've noted that there are aspects, including important aspects of truth and important insights here. This is something that was also pointed out, for example, in Great Objectives and Grand Strategy, GO&GS, speaking to how the functioning of the more unrestrained market and of capitalist relations generally in this period has in fact given rise to a certain spiritual malaise, and that in turn this spiritual malaise has been utilized, has led to some degree spontaneously, has been consciously played on and utilized by powerful sections of the ruling class to draw people toward and into religious fundamentalism. So there's some important reality being spoken to here, but as far as it goes, so to speak. But Lerner only addresses what are ultimately only more outward and secondary expressions of a deeper and more essential problem. The fundamental problem, then, is more profound. It lies in deeper analysis, deeper dynamics and causes. It lies ultimately in the fundamental contradiction of capitalism itself, which leads to the fact that exploitation is the driving means through which wealth is produced and accumulated under capitalism, and that it is produced socially but appropriated privately by capital. The deeper basis for the more outward expressions that Lerner speaks to are the production relations and the dynamics of capitalist accumulation through the working out of this fundamental contradiction, and the associated social relations, and the expression of all that in the superstructure in many different ways. One of the things that's important to stress in this regard is that production relations are not just and not essentially relations of distribution. And this is mainly what Lerner is focusing on when he focuses on the market. The market is the outward expression of deeper and more inner production relations. As Marx said, in an overall sense, the system of production determines the system of distribution. The fact that things are distributed through capitalist market mechanisms flows from the ownership system, from the production relations overall, and from that fundamental contradiction of capitalism between socialized production and private appropriation. In an overall sense, whatever is the system of production, there will be a corresponding system of distribution. And in an overall sense, the latter, the system of distribution, is derivative, derives from, and corresponds to the fundamental nature of the means and relations through which production is carried out and accumulation is carried out. So the relations of production, most fundamentally and essentially the ownership system and the contradictions within that, basically determine the system and nature of distribution and of distribution relations. So it's a deeper phenomenon. If you merely try to change the market relations without getting to the root of this and uprooting it, you will not be able ultimately to do so. Along with this, it has to be noted that there is more than a little romanticization or romanticizing in Lerner of feudalism in contrast to capitalism. He talks several times about how he's not saying feudalism was a good system, but he's saying that while it was a system of exploitation, there were certain ways in which that exploitation was mitigated, was mediated, was modified in certain senses by the effects of other institutions in feudal society, and guess which one in particular, the church and religion. Whereas under capitalism, it's more naked and without the modifying influences, if you will, of these so much of these institutions. And it wouldn't surprise us to see that Lerner thinks there should be more religion and spirituality in American society and in the public sphere in particular. And actually, this calls to mind certain critiques that are made in the Communist Manifesto of certain forms of feudal critiques of capitalism and even feudal forms of advocacy of socialism, where notions that actually correspond to feudal relations are mixed up with and sometimes presented in the form of what is alleged to be socialism. These institutions, such as the church and religion, were a tremendous weight reinforcing and adding to the oppression and misery of the masses of people in feudal society, not a force mitigating and modifying it, lessening the effect of this oppression. They were an additional burden reinforcing and chaining the masses down further and weighing on them in its own right with the ignorance and superstition that was spread through these means. Now, here the following point in The Truth About Right-Wing Conspiracy and Why Clinton and the Democrats Are No Answer, written during the Clinton impeachment process, is relevant to what Lerner is raising that does have aspects of truth and importance, but also points to the limitations in his views and the ways in which his outlook also leads him in the wrong direction. Quote, in some important aspects, the recovery of the U.S. economy that has taken place during the Clinton administration and the more highly globalized and flexible production that has been a marked feature of this recovery has also contributed to undermining the traditional family. And it has fostered the fluorescence of an outlook, particularly though not exclusively, among more highly paid professionals that involves no small amount of self-indulgence, and related to that, a weakening of some traditional values, including old-style patriotism and the willingness to sacrifice for the officially defined and proclaimed national interest. In some significant ways, what was written 150 years ago in the Communist Manifesto concerning the consequences of unfettered bourgeois commodity relations is assuming a pronounced expression among sections of the U.S. population in the context of today's post-Cold War world capitalism. The following phrases from the manifesto have a particular and powerful resonance. Quote, "The bourgeoisie, wherever it has gotten the upper hand, has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, than callous cash payment. It has drowned the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism in the icy water of egotistical calculation. It has resolved personal worth into exchange value. In a word, for exploitation veiled by religious and political illusions, it has substituted naked, shameless, direct, brutal exploitation." End of the quote from the manifesto. And then right-wing conspiracy goes on. "There is a great irony here. The very triumph and triumphalism of capitalism in today's circumstances has produced effects and sentiments which tend to undermine, among significant sections of the U.S. population, the willingness to make personal sacrifices for God and country, that is, for the interests and requirements of the imperial ruling class within the U.S. itself and in the world arena. In reaction to this, the conservatives, with the Christian right playing a decisive role, are attempting to revive and impose precisely," quoting again from the manifesto, "the most heavenly ecstasies of religious fervor, of chivalrous enthusiasm, of Philistine sentimentalism, to resurrect a situation where worldwide exploitation that is unsurpassed in its brutality is at the same time veiled by religious and political illusions." That was a very important point that was made in the right-wing conspiracy. Here it is important to observe, among other things, that in these incisive passages in the Communist Manifesto on the naked expressions of capitalist exploitation and in the critique of capitalism in general, Marx and Engels were not looking backward to an idyllic, idealized, and romanticized version of a vision of feudalism with all its very real horrors. But in contrast, we're looking forward to the overthrow and advance of humanity beyond capitalism and all systems of exploitation and oppression and any of their adornments, apologies, and rationalizations. Now, in this light, we can see even more clearly the very severe shortcomings in Lerner's analysis of the religious right, even though the purpose of his book is, as he puts it, to take back our country from the religious right. And even in that formulation, you can see the limitations suggested. So we can see that his approach to combating, or perhaps more accurately said, attracting people away from the religious right, is not one that can succeed even in its own aims, on its own terms. His analysis, in general and in particular of the religious right, is marked by a failure to grasp and fully confront the fascist nature of what is represented by this, the depth of the danger it actually poses, and of the kind of thoroughgoing and resolute struggle that must be waged to defeat it, while at the same time, yes, seeking to win as many people as possible away from it. But repeatedly you see learners saying, well, I'll strongly disagree with these people, but I won't say they're bad people. Well, that's not really the issue, bad people or good people. The issue is what kind of program and ideology are these people being mobilized around, and what does that represent? And how serious of a problem does that pose if you're trying to get to a more just society, let alone get to communism? Lerner's limitations here are directly related to his own world outlook, to his proceeding from and through a religious standpoint and prism, including his notion that there is too little religion and spirituality in American life and society. Too little. While the religion and spirituality that Lerner advocates and wants to foster and see flourish further and exert greater influence, as embodied in his conception of the left hand of God, is in many significant ways very different from the religious fundamentalism of the Christian fascists, still Lerner does share the same religious traditions with them, in a broad sense, and his beliefs are rooted in and flow from the same religious scriptures, even if Lerner's views and beliefs involve some ways of interpreting this scripture and tradition that are significantly different from how the fundamentalist fascists read and apply and seek to enforce all this. Lerner's conviction and insistence that the religious and spiritual worldview and approach to reality needs to exert more of an influence in society actually promotes a way of seeing and acting in the world that is in fact in essential conflict with reality, and therefore with a means for actually changing reality in accordance with the real and fundamental interests of masses of people and ultimately of humanity as a whole. And along with this, despite his very real differences with the reactionary, even fascist religious fundamentalists, Lerner's insistence on the promotion of the same religious traditions and scriptures cannot help but contribute to the promotion of reactionary religious-based ideological and political viewpoints and programs and actions flowing from them, because regardless of how Lerner might seek to, in fact, reinterpret these traditions and these scriptures, they do, after all, stand for what they stand for. They do, after all, say what they say and mean what they mean. And the limitations here of Lerner, once again, are bound up with why he does not recognize the depth and, yes, the antagonism that objectively exists between even what he is seeking to do and what is represented, not by the individuals who may be drawn to be the rank and file, if you will, of this fascist movement, but by the basic character and content of that movement and where it is seeking to take things. In other words, it's important to come to grips, to confront what is the real nature of the quote-unquote religious right, its character as a Christian fascist movement, aiming for a theocratic fascist society and form of capitalist imperialist rule and domination throughout the world, putting forward and embodying in a concentrated way patriarchy, opposition to the rights of women and to the emancipation of women, to the rights of gays, a whole macho stand. God, guns, and gays. Or in another variation, God, guns, and guts. Let's keep all three. These are the popular expressions of these fascist sentiments and program. These are not just slogans, and it doesn't matter if the people themselves, I mean, it's irrelevant and not the way to approach things to ask whether the people who have bumper stickers like this are good people or bad people. The question is, what program are they being mobilized around? What's the content of that program? And how do you take this on and even, yes, win people away from it? And can you do so without offending anyone? This Christian fascist movement is not only powerfully built around and has as a major engine the forceful reassertion of absolutist kind of patriarchy, but also, as I've spoken to already, white supremacy, the Bible Belt and the lynching belt, with a whole genocidal dimension. And its link with militarism and the aggressive military marauding of U.S. imperialism, as I've spoken to previously in this talk. It has a whole thrust against the acceptance and recognition, not just by individuals, but by the society, of the scientific fact of evolution. Why? Because it is necessary, in order to further this program, to promote an epistemology that causes people to move away from rational thought, to move further away from a scientific method, and once again, to in fact, be enslaved to not only a superstitious, but to a forcefully patriarchal ideology which fosters and insists upon unthinking obedience to the dominant forces and relations in society. The battle around evolution is important in its own right and has a great deal to do with the battle for revolution. It is, first of all, a battle in the realm of epistemology. Are we going to proceed according to a scientific approach and a rational approach to reality, to investigate reality, to interact with other parts of reality, to accumulate experience, to accumulate evidence about reality, and then to draw rational conclusions? Or are we going to blindly adopt an outmoded way of understanding how the world works and what its driving forces are, and insist upon superimposing that over reality and on smashing down anything which conflicts with that non-rational and irrational approach to reality? Are we going to insist on epistemologically a priori notions of truth, which are not drawn from reality and not testable in reality, and rule out of order things which are drawn from reality and have been tested and shown in reality to be true because they conflict with a worldview that is bound up with all these oppressive relations, including very prominently patriarchy and more fundamentally the whole capitalist ensemble of oppressive and exploitive relations and its role in the world as it asserts itself in the realm of the international arena in the era of imperialism. So it's an epistemological battle. There's a political struggle around evolution, but a political struggle about epistemology. Some people have religious beliefs who accept the scientific fact of evolution, and they find a way to try to reconcile that. Ultimately, if you take it to its logical extension, those are not reconcilable, but in the short term, many people seek to do that. And many of them are capable of working it out in such a way that they embrace at least the basic realities that are concentrated in the explanation or the theory in a scientific sense of evolution, even while they cling to religious beliefs. But we're talking about something radically different than that. We're talking about something that defines truth according to a priori, in advance of and divorced from investigating and synthesizing what's learned from reality, and which is not just an a priorism in general, but is an a priorism that serves an entire reactionary political program to enforce a certain kind of rule within the U.S. in terms of the capitalist dictatorship, and to use that as a battering ram and an ideological sword in the international domination that's being extended or attempting to be extended on a whole new level by U.S. imperialism. So this is why evolution has become such a concentration of such sharp struggle. You know, the worldview, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. That's a self-contained worldview that can't be penetrated by reality unless and until reality becomes so forceful that it explodes that worldview in one way or another. But logically, rationally, it can't be penetrated by anything that happens in reality. And you can see how this is A, important in its own right, and B, extremely important in the context of what the U.S. imperialists, led by this core now at the center of power, is seeking to do in the world, and therefore what it has to do in this country, and the unthinking kind of obedience that it has to have in the context of that. How it goes along with the constant invoking of, we're at war, this is a time of war. And how they see this as the necessary steel band, if you will, holding together all the ways in which, or tightly gripping around all the ways in which what they're setting out to do in the world is likely to cause things to fly in sharply opposed directions and to polarize. And there's an attempt to create a self-contained world. I mean, one of the things, for example, about science, one of the key aspects of having something accepted as a valid scientific theory is what's called peer review. That people who are knowledgeable in the field review the work that you have done, because there is specialization, and even scientists in various fields are not necessarily up on the latest things in science in another field. So peer review, the people who are knowledgeable in the field in which a theory is being brought forward, reviewing that and seeing if they can punch holes in it, if you will, is a crucial part of what of determining whether something should be accepted as valid or not. Well, the Christian fascists are seeking actually now, besides trying to create, you know, and recreate the God of the gaps in relation to evolution, every time some new evidence brought forward, such as a new fossil discovery, oh, well, that now there are two gaps, one on either side of that one, and all similar sort of specious argumentation, faulty argumentation. They're also working now to set up institutions where pretty soon they will be able to declare that creationism has been subjected to peer review by creationist scientists, and therefore it is valid. This goes along with a whole dimension, which I'll talk about at another time, of what people like Horowitz are attempting to do with the universities, where they're attempting to rule out of order, not on a religious basis explicitly, but on the basis of basically treason, attempting to rule out of order anything that would call into question not only specific acts of what the U.S. is doing, but more specifically anything foundational from which you might call into question or criticize those actions. It's an attempt to purge out of public life, beginning with academia, any attempt to have a footing from which to call into question what the U.S. is doing in the world or within this country, what the ruling class is doing, and to create a self-contained and self-reinforcing world. And that's one dimension, but this Christian fascism is a whole broader dimension of seeking to do that, including epistemologically. They run into certain contradictions. For example, they have all these, they're building more and more of these Christian and financing all these Christian fascist schools in place of public schools up through the high schools. But then there's a problem. The kids go to high school and all these parents who are attracted to it don't want their kids to be in the lower tier of society. They want them to have careers, not to have a broad not to have an education on a broad foundation, but to have enough education to raise the value of their commodity, to make more money, to put it simply. And right now you have the established institutions. If you go into universities all across the country at this point and you take biology, they're going to teach evolution as a fact. Because it is. So they got, you know, and it, because you can't really teach biology without teaching that. So this is a problem for this whole Christian fascist force. All these young people that they reared in this tradition then go to these universities and bam, they run right up against the fact that evolution is presented to them as a well-established fact. And they're trying to find various ways to work around this. They have summer camps where they send high school graduates to prepare them. So this is all the secular stuff you're going to hear when you go to the university, all that secular humanist stuff. And all this stuff about evolution and all the rest of that. So here's what you learn how to say to pass the test. But remember, Genesis is really true. And the rest of this is all lies and nonsense. You go to that exhibit in the museum in New York about Darwin and evolution, that's all lies. And they have whole tours where they take them to these quote-unquote creationist museums where you learn that the Grand Canyon was formed by the flood of Noah. They're trying, they're moving, they have an acute contradiction because they have to have some science to do what they're seeking to do in the world economically and militarily. But for the population in general, they need a population that's trained to not think critically and to accept this absolutist worldview that is not based on engaging and actually understanding reality. And which translates, there's this battle in the realm of epistemology, but it closely interconnects with and carries over into all kinds of political spheres. If you believe there's a higher truth than scientific truth, than truth founded in reality, then you can say, as some of these people do, that Bush didn't lie around Iraq because he is carrying out God's will in the world, and that's higher than any fact you can cite about some statement Bush may or may not have made on some occasion. It doesn't matter. There's a higher truth involved. And when you get people thinking in this kind of a way, short of a major eruption in their lives and in the society they're part of, it's relatively, not absolutely, relatively impenetrable. And you see the kind of fanaticism that goes along with this, that can be mobilized to trample down any kind of opposition to the assertion of the powerful father figure going out in the world to beat down the devil before the devil comes and gets us where we live. This is what's at stake in this epistemological battle and its political connections. And it links up with other crucial epistemological questions. And the reason I'm raising this in the context of discussing Michael Lerner's book is that, as we'll see as we go along, his epistemology incorporates, as well as making significant concessions, to thinking which is ultimately not rational thinking. And it also relates to his view of what is represented by and the extent and depth of the danger represented by this Christian fascist force, as we correctly identify it. He even falls into attributing much of the growth of this force to not only mistakes but arrogance of the left, as he conceives of it, including which in which he includes the Democratic Party in a general sense. And that the fact that the left has made no room for religion in society and has insisted on secularism has contributed to and fostered an atmosphere in which people seeking for spirituality and higher meaning are driven to the right. This is a large part of his explanation for the growth of this phenomenon. And this is an explanation which only speaks very secondarily and in a very limited way to certain aspects of this, and not only misses but misrepresents the essence of what is going on. This is a movement which is responding to challenges to certain privileges and to the traditional ways in which the oppressive and exploitative relations of the system have been formulated and carried out through the working of the system. And in particular, once again, in a concentrated way, this takes shape around patriarchy. The challenge of the role of women in society, and now, for God's sake, all these gay people running around. The whole way in which the traditional values associated with and given significant expression through patriarchy are being challenged at various turns. And along with that, the whole way in which it's the, going back to the Kevin Phillips comments from earlier, the way in which American exceptionalism, the special relationship of America with God and its chosen destiny and covenant with God, and therefore its special manifest destiny and mission in the world, all wrapped up with religious fundamentalism, all of this is being challenged in the practical realm and struggle throughout the world, and ideologically and politically by a significant section of American society, which for a variety of reasons and coming from different viewpoints does not accept to varying degrees these views and is challenging them. The popular expression that you hear fairly broadly, that an American life is not more valuable than an Iraqi life or any other life, this is completely alien and antagonistic to this absolutist, traditionalist, you know, religious fundamentalist view. They're in antagonistic opposition, even while that doesn't represent a, by any means, a fully communist or proletarian viewpoint. And these people are being mobilized around a program which Lerner does not really confront and come to grips with or even fully recognize, which is absolutely determined that the only way the rightful place of things in the world, in American society, in America's role in the world, the only way that can be reasserted and reestablished, as they say it, as they see it, is through the imposition of a theocratic form of government. This is a Christian nation. It's those secular people that got prayer out of the schools, started teaching evolution in the schools, got us away from the Word of God. That's why we're in the trouble we're in today and why people are attacking us and blowing up buildings in New York City and why we've got to go get them in the world before they get us. Ironically, while one can point to real shortcomings and mistakes in the quote-unquote left, broadly speaking, including, as I've spoken to elsewhere, a paralyzing influence of rampant relativism, it is fundamentally misguided and disarming ideologically and politically to attribute the rise of this Christian fascist movement and its powerful connections and support and fostering from the highest levels of government and from the centers of power of the ruling class to mistakes or arrogance on the part of the left. There is a way in which the failure of an actual revolution coming through the whole upsurge of the 60s has actually been turned into a factor that has contributed to the rise of some of this religious fundamentalism. But it's not in the sense that Lerner speaks of it. It's not because of the arrogance. It's not that there's no arrogance among people on the left. But what are the actual defining and driving dynamics here? Many things were called into question not just in the realm of theory, although that was extremely important, but in practice through political struggle that are foundational to this society through the upsurge of the 60s. And there were many changes that were brought about partly as a result of the political struggle and partly because of underlying changes in the economic base. For example, the whole change in the position of many women, particularly among professionals and other sections of the middle class, where it became both possible and necessary for women to work full-time, frequently on the, you know, to the same degree as men, in order to try to maintain a middle-class standard of living. When you combine that with political movements of feminism and other things that came forward out of the 60s, it did pose a very direct challenge to the traditionally institutionalized forms of oppression in the society. But it didn't go all the way. It didn't overthrow and uproot the foundation, the political enforcement, and then get at the foundation of those relations. And as that movement receded, and in the context where there was a regrouping by the ruling class and an assault on many of these things, there was a retreat on the part of particularly the more middle strata who'd been part of that movement, and many of the forms that the formerly much more radical expressions of this struggle took now became much more limited, narrow, reformist, devolved down into and got reduced down into identity politics, sometimes, frankly, yes, in rather stupid forms, narrow and petty forms, which didn't get at the essence of and at the heart and the foundation of the what all this oppression was rooted in, and instead often turned into a form, once again, of narrow commodity competition. So in a very secondary form, this contributes indirectly, if you will, to the growth of this Christian fascist force. But it's in no way the essential reason or the defining reason why this has grown. This is a movement, as I said, that is being led from on high, and not God, but sections of the ruling class, which have made the determination that given what they're setting out to do in the world, and in light of how they see the role, the necessary role of the U.S. in the world, and what the character of U.S. society needs to be, that it's necessary to hold this together and to make it effective, to have it be able to effect what it needs to effect. In other words, that the form of rule in a society has to change to one that is essentially and perhaps even openly theocratic, based on a Christian fundamentalism. And these forces are absolutely relentless in this. And the foot soldiers of this, whether good people or not, are being trained to be soldiers for this right now, largely in a political and ideological sense, but already potentially in a military sense. Perhaps, ironically, we could say that Rabbi Rudin has a better understanding of this than Rabbi Lerner, even though in some ways Lerner has some more progressive positions. Not that Rudin's an outright reactionary, but some of Lerner's positions are more progressive. But Rudin has grasped very clearly, even with his limitations, that this is an unrelenting movement that is determined to change the character of the society and how it's ruled, not to something other than capitalism, as we would understand, but to change the form and in important ways some of the particular instrumentalities through which the oppressive nature of the system is carried out and enforced. He's very clear, for example, makes it very clear. This is very refreshing to read in his book, Baptizing America. He says, look, if these people, some people think you can compromise with these people about abortion. They are completely mistaken. If they win around abortion, it will only whet their appetite to go after other things, including birth control, and we're already seeing that. The same line of attack that has been waged by these people against abortion is now being waged against birth control, right down to the level that it's interfering with God's plan. Again, when things are made on that level, you see, once you get into that self-contained world, You can't argue that on the terms in which people are used to struggling things out. So this is one important thing that Rudin, the Rabbi Rudin, grasps more fully and correctly than the Rabbi Lerner. You're not going to take on and defeat this Christian fascist force, everything it represents and everything bound up with it, and you are not going to win significant numbers of people away from it without taking on in a very direct and forceful way, and yes, without offending people. People have to be challenged fundamentally and foundationally in the context of building a movement that is not only opposed to this Christian fascism, but is aiming increasingly and led by a force which is consciously aiming for the overturning and transforming of the whole society and the uprooting of all the oppressive relations which this Christian fascist movement is seeking to reinforce in new forms, in openly, extremely oppressive forms. And we can see that in the course of challenging and, yes, even offending people, people can change. Not just individuals, but masses of people. We experienced this on a grand scale in the 60s. I knew many people in the course of the 60s movements who would say, well, you know, I used to be a Goldwater Republican, who became very radical in the 60s. Now, there is a particularity of this religious fundamentalism and its epistemology which has a tighter hold on people, but it also, let's come back to this reality, it is also crashing up against the way the world really is. And that provides important material basis for wrenching people out of this, but that's what's involved, wrenching them out of it. Not that that should be the main focus, is winning over the people in that movement, but it should be one aim and part of the orientation of what needs to be done, repolarizing as many people away from that as possible as part of building an overall movement which is concentrated to a significant degree now in driving out the Bush regime, but from our standpoint and from the understanding we have and from a scientific assessment and analysis needs to go all the way to the uprooting and overturning and transforming of the system and the society. Instead, and in opposition to this, we see that Lerner's position ideologically interconnects with and finds expression in an ultimate and essential reformism. Throughout his book, he keeps talking about how the left can get back into power, as though it's a question of whether the right or the left, in some classless sense, holds power, rather than you're up against a system that is ruled by a class which in turn is rooted in the underlying production relations, gives expression to all these corresponding social relations, and finds in turn its expression in the superstructure, including one or another form of bourgeois dictatorship as the political rule. And Lerner even identifies the left often with the Democrats. If the Democrats will just take up this program of being willing to challenge this way of life, to which he does have some, in relation to which he does have valid critiques, but he actually believes that you can influence a section of what is objectively the ruling class, as represented by a Democratic Party, to adopt this kind of program. And he recognizes that people are going to accuse him of being unrealistic, because he keeps answering his book, well, people say this is unrealistic, but, you know, first of all, isn't it better than the alternative? And second of all, what's so realistic about these other, and what's so positive about the way things are now and the way the political alignment is now? But there's no recognition that this is the Democratic Party and the left, as he identified it for that matter, is a superstructural expression of underlying production and social relations. And the dynamics of capitalist accumulation through those production relations, and that this establishes the framework within which even relative autonomy and initiative in the superstructure takes place and is ultimately conditioned and limited. And you cannot win the Democratic Party to this because from the point of view of that foundation, his program is totally unrealistic and unrealizable. Even leaving aside the parts of it that we would disagree with, even aspects of which we would disagree with strongly, it's totally unrealizable within the confines of what is not merely a capitalist market in its effect, but the much more profound basis in which this market and all the other outer manifestations of the relations in society are grounded and by which and the contradictions by which they're driven. And the severe limitations of his ideological as well as political viewpoint, I'm tempted to say, maybe it's not fair, never trust somebody religious when it comes to the patriarchy. Maybe that's unfair, we'll see. But it's not incidental that the ideological and political limitations of Lerner take very stark and concentrated expression around the question of abortion, where he puts forward really, to be honest, quite horrific positions, which in turn reflect in a concentrated way some of the fundamental weaknesses of his overall outlook and approach. So let's get into that and see how that's so. In a chapter entitled Significantly, The Family, Sexuality, and Personal Responsibility in the Left Hand of God, Lerner starts right out in a section on abortion with the by now all too familiar formula or mantra, make it safe, legal, and rare. In this and overall, it can be seen how Lerner's position on this question is closely in line with that of bourgeois politicians like Bill and Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and the Democratic Party leadership in general. Now, Lerner does say that, quote, spiritual progressives should be unequivocal in opposing attempts to make abortion illegal. But then he immediately adds, but we should be equally unequivocal in recognizing abortion as a tragic loss. And things go further downhill from there. He makes the claim that, quote, most women who have gone through abortions will tell you how very emotionally painful it has been to experience this loss of life. There are two things, two essential things wrong with this. First of all, it's not true. Factually not true, far from the truth. And second of all, to the degree that there is any truth to it, this can't be divorced. In other words, to the degree that it does apply to some women, this can't be divorced from the larger social context in which there has been a whole right-wing assault around the whole question of abortion, politically and ideologically and morally, and in which liberals and progressives, including people like Lerner, as well as ruling class politicians like the Clintons and Gore, have been ceding the moral ground and joining in the chorus declaring this a tragedy, even if people like Lerner do not believe it should be literally and legally made into a crime. Listen to this language from Lerner, and keep in mind that he is talking here about abortion. Quote, the miracle of life flowing through us deserves to be treated with sanctity and care, and when life is snuffed out, this is an occasion for communal sadness and mourning. Not even individual, communal sadness and mourning. Here I feel like the old joke about the Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger is out with Tonto, and they're surrounded by, you know, the bandits and everything. And they start pinning him down and shooting at him, and then they're running out of ammunition. And finally, the Lone Ranger turns to Tonto and says, well, looks like we're in bad shape, Tonto. And Tonto says, what do you mean we, white man? What do you mean the life flowing through us, white man? The miracle of life flowing through us deserves to be treated with sanctity and care. And when life is snuffed out, this is an occasion for communal sadness and mourning. Note the choice of words, snuffed out, which does, after all, sound very much like a description of the wanton taking of human life, something akin to, if not literally, murder. And even the more benign or supposedly joyful-sounding word, miracle, insinuates a feel of mysticism about the process of reproduction. Childbearing, if it is wanted, intended, and planned for, may well bring great joy, but there is nothing mystical about the process, and identifying it with notions of the miraculous, and especially when phrases are employed like the miracle of life flowing through us, fosters a sense that childbearing is somehow a duty, one imbued with a sense of religious obligation. Note also how Lerner makes the tragedy, quote-unquote, of abortion one that involves not only the woman, but also the whole community. And in line with this view of this as a kind of communal experience, note again how Lerner speaks of, with very deliberate language, the miracle of life flowing through us. This, as we will see, is not accidental or incidental phrasing. Just a minute ago, when I quoted Lerner saying that abortion is a tragic loss, I did not actually and deliberately did not cite his whole statement there, but held part of it back. Here is what follows immediately from Lerner. Abortion involves a tragic loss, he says, quote, not only for the individual woman, but also for the entire community. And a little later, Lerner argues that the loss of life in abortion, quote, affects not only the woman, but the man who was part of the conception and the community in which this woman lives and the entire global community. Lerner's view is that this position, quote, does not relieve one of the burden and moral responsibility of making these choices. And he is careful to add, quote, nor does it empower a community to intervene and make our choices for us. But having said that, he goes on, quote, but it situates us as fundamentally linked to one another and as having some responsibility to check in with others about the impact of our actions on them. Now, he says, this is not a checking in that can or should be legally mandated. And he goes on, I talked above about building a movement that created an ethos in a liberal and progressive culture that was disapproving of the demeaning of sexuality. So too, he goes on, we should seek to create an ethos in which women feel invited to consult and receive support from others affected by their decision to abort. And conversely, for those involved to offer support and comfort should such a decision be taken by the pregnant woman. At every stage of the process, he says, the relevant community needs to be involved in a caring and supportive way. And one of the main forms of support and caring that Lerner advocates is that, as he puts it, quote, a spiritual community should be there to provide emotional and spiritual support, to make it possible for the woman to really grieve the loss and to affirm a shared vision of the sanctity of life. And Lerner even goes so far as to call for ceremonies to formalize this individual and communal grieving. For, get this, he calls for, quote, rituals of mourning and purification to acknowledge what is, in the absence of these rituals, usually experienced as a personal tragedy. Now, here it has to be said, straight out. Despite the language of caring, community, nurturing, and support, these views of learners and the implications of what he advocates will very rightly cause shudders among people with a deep understanding or even a basic sense of how for thousands of years, not only the force of the state, but also social customs and traditions, and yes, the pressure of the community, have been used to maintain women in an oppressed condition and to punish them, often in the harshest and cruelest of ways, where they have sought to break out of these oppressive confines. Here I'm reminded of what Richard Pryor said about how he didn't like to hear white people use the word nigger. He said it made him respond the same way as when he heard good old boys shouting in the middle of the night, "Yee-haw!" Sent shivers down his spine, and not in a good way. Despite any disclaimers and whatever learner's intent, the fact is that what he calls for around abortion would in reality amount to nothing less than perpetuating patriarchal oppression and even the worst horrors associated with it, and institutionalizing the communal enforcement of patriarchal traditions, values, and relations, reinforced by wrapping women in a heavy shroud of guilt. And it must be said that what Lerner puts forward here is not that far removed from the bloody sheet of the wedding night. Not surprisingly, there's a very close link between these genuinely horrific views of Lerner's and his sentimentality about the family. He writes, quote, "No matter what our own child experiences may have been, no matter how much we had to struggle later in life to repair some of the damage done by less than perfect parents, almost all of us recognize that the family is the only institution in our society whose explicit goal is to provide love and caring." And here one has to ask exactly what world is being talked about here. It's not to say there aren't loving and caring parents, but what has been the experiences down through thousands of years and today, especially for women in the context and confines of the family? Far from this sentimental and romanticized view. Right down to today in so-called modern society, tremendous horrors have been perpetuated and perpetrated in the context of the family. Let's remember, as I pointed out in Preaching from a Pulpit of Bones, that it was only within the last 15 to 20 years that the concept of marital rape was not considered a contradiction in terms. Let's not forget what I also pointed out there, that women and children are more likely to be abused sexually and otherwise in the family by the man, the head of the household, more than anywhere else in society. So to say the least, and to wildly understate, this is an extremely romanticized notion of the oppressive relations that still essentially and fundamentally define the family as a patriarchal institution and as an integral part of the overall oppressive relations of capitalist society, notwithstanding the intentions and efforts of many parents, even including fathers, to have some other kinds of relationships. Now, Lerner is not entirely ignorant of, nor does he entirely ignore, the reality and history of oppression associated with the family. But in line with his overall views, he does not present this as something bound up, not only historically, but also inexorably, inevitably, with the division of society into classes, something that is bound to exist as an integral and essential part of any society ruled by an exploiting class, most definitely including modern capitalist society. Lerner's approach to this is accordingly one of reformism, which cannot and will not provide the means for getting to the roots of and finally abolishing patriarchy and the oppression of women. Lerner puts it this way. Of course, not all families live up to the ideal of being a place where genuine caring and nurturance are given. We ought to give some kind of award for understatement there. Nor have families always represented our highest values. 2 years in a row we'll get an award. Our great achievement of the 20th century was our realization that the patriarchal family oppressed women and children and supported class divisions in the larger society by legitimating the notion that inequalities of power are natural. Spiritual progressives seek to encourage, he goes on, the evolution of families from a structure based on domination to one founded on a spiritual partnership. Note first, evolution, not revolution, which is what is really required. And along with the other limitations of and contradictions in Lerner's position here, the unavoidable fact is that, as I have discussed in this talk and elsewhere, the spiritual and religious traditions and related values that he wants to base things on are themselves powerful forces serving to rationalize and to reinforce patriarchy and the oppression of women. The failure to rupture with those traditions and values is completely interwoven with the failure to get to the roots of, and with an inability to lead the way or even to fully see the way to rooting out that oppression, and indeed all oppression. So we see that in this context, once again, Lerner completely, besides some of his horrific positions, even in some of his better statements, he completely fails with regard to abortion and also with regard to birth control to understand what is going on with the whole attack on this, and let alone to take a correct position in relation to it, as should be obvious from what I've read so far. He fails to understand or agree with that there is absolutely no good basis, and that it is entirely wrong in principle to seek to find any common ground at all with people not only seeking to outlaw abortion, but to present it as morally wrong, even if it shouldn't be declared illegal. And once again, his views contrast with those of Rabbi Rudin, who understands more correctly what is actually going on here. That the attack around abortion, and now openly coming out in an additional dimension of attacking birth control, pharmacists, laws being passed that pharmacists don't have to fulfill prescriptions for birth control, even for married women. I mean, it's bad enough they don't have to do it for women who aren't married, but even for married women. This makes very clear, and should make clear to everyone, that what is at the heart of this whole issue is not the killing of babies, which is scientifically wrong in the first place, but is the chaining of women in oppressive relations in which their essential role is reduced to that of property and breeders for men, according to God's plan and dictates. To get a fuller sense of this, it's worth citing an article in the New York Times Magazine of May 7th of 2006, entitled "The War on Contraception" by Russell Shorto. Among other horrors there, he refers to what are called by these Christian fundamentalists purity balls and purity rings. Shorto quotes Leslie Unruh, a sponsor of these purity balls, where fathers attend with their teenage daughters. "We think the relationship between fathers and their daughters is the key," she says. Shorto further describes these purity balls. Quote, at the purity ball, a father gives a purity ring to his daughter, a symbol of the promises she makes to maintain her marriage virginity for her future husband. Then during her marriage ceremony, the daughter gives the ring to her new husband. Among other things, the appropriate word for this is sick. As a comrade commented when I read the above description to them, this conjures up visions of incest and cattle auctions all at once. And once again, how far away is this from the bloody sheet of the wedding night and the death penalty if the sheet is not bloody? Now, interestingly, along with this, while he seeks to uphold the rights of homosexuals and oppose the attacks on them from the Christian right as he sees it, in order to try to reconcile this with the religious traditions of which he's a part and wants to advocate in a general sense, Lerner is forced into some of the most astounding and ridiculous contortions. For example, everybody, you know, who's been part of this debate knows about the famous quotation in Leviticus 18, or the famous statement in Leviticus 18:22 about a man not having sex with another man. Thou shalt not lie with a man as with a woman. It is an abomination. Well, Lerner says, now notice the language. Thou shalt not lie with a man as with a woman. Maybe that could be interpreted to mean it's okay to lie with a man in another way. I'm not kidding. Because we know that what are the consequences. You go on to Leviticus 20:13, and what does it say is the penalty for a man lying with another man as with a woman? Death. And I'm sorry, there's no reasonable interpretation of this statement, other than it means you can't have sex with a man as you are properly supposed to have sex with a woman within the right confines of property relations. There's no other reasonable interpretation of this. I don't think there's any way you could say that the Bible is saying, when you have sex with a woman, have it in the missionary position. But if you have sex with a man, you won't be able to do that, so naturally you'll have to have it in another position. Next, I want to move on and talk about Lerner's views of awe and wonder. This is a repeated theme in his book, The Need of Human Beings for Awe and Wonder. Now, there is something to agree with and some validity and importance to this. This is something I have brought out in a number of writings and talks, including preaching from a pulpit of bones. But there are two significant problems and significant differences we have here with Lerner's views. First of all, frequently, while on occasion he'll just refer to awe and wonder, frequently he will follow it by awe and wonder at creation. So right away he's brought in a religious element into this and made this religious experience, as he presents it, of appreciation for or being struck by awe and wonder, he's made this necessarily a religious experience. And if you understand, as a scientific viewpoint leads you to understand, that there is no creation in that sense, then you understand how, well, awe and wonder is important. It is not and cannot be awe and wonder at creation, but at the multiple forms and changingness of nature and the way in which it presents itself in many diverse and often unexpected ways. Secondly, Lerner is one-sided on awe and wonder. Owing to the influence of his idealism and metaphysics, he doesn't grasp the dialectical relation between, as we would say, materialism and romanticism. Between the experience of awe and wonder on the one hand and solving mysteries on the other hand, which will be a continuous, never-ending process as long as human beings exist. So to put it another way, we need awe and wonder, but not superstitious awe. In observations on art and culture, science and philosophy, I spoke to both sides of the picture, both aspects of the contradictions involved. And there I said, human beings do need to be amazed. You don't need religion to realize or appreciate that. In the motion of the material world and the interaction of human beings with the rest of reality, mysteries get resolved and new mysteries emerge. And I've also emphasized, for example, in preaching from a pulpit of bones, that communism, as I put it then, the real vibrant communism of Marx, Lenin, and Mao, not the phony, lifeless communism of Khrushchev, Brezhnev, and Deng Xiaoping, does not weigh down on but gives the fullest flight to the human spirit, to the imagination and the continual pondering of things which at any point are the source of mystery and of awe. Communism rejects the notion that mystery and awe must be identified only with things that cannot be known or understood, that the highest expression of this mystery and awe is belief in some unknowable and ineffable, in other words, unexpressible essence beyond material reality, and that we should obliterate the distinction between imagination and objective reality through the pretense that the supernatural forces and beings that human beings have created in their imagination are not only real, but are the ruling and controlling forces of existence. And this is also spoken to in Materialism and Romanticism, Can We Do Without Myth, which is also in the Observations book. So another way to put this is that materialism and mystery form another contradiction. They're another unity of opposites. A materialist and dialectical method enables us to explore mysteries, sometimes to resolve them. It enables us to appreciate them even before resolving them, and to appreciate them after we have resolved them, and to recognize that new mysteries will continually arise, including in relation to ones we resolve. And here I want to cite the following from the series that appeared in our newspaper, which is soon to be published as a book, The Science of Evolution and the Myth of Creationism, Knowing What's Real and Why It Matters, since it powerfully expresses an answer to Lerner and to those who hold similar views concerning the fundamental question of how to appreciate human existence and its relation to the larger universe, to the rest of material reality. Quoting, it says, "We now know that our human evolution, as well as the evolution of all living things, can be explained by entirely natural processes and requires no supernatural explanations. But will our ability to increasingly understand life without God leave us feeling in some way adrift and empty? Why should it? We still can and should be duly amazed, sustained, and even humbled by the recognition of the wonders of diversity and complexity that naturally evolving life can itself bring forth, and by both the limitations and ongoing potentials of our own humanity. Far from being a recipe for a gray, cold, and passionless outlook, a truly materialist scientific method, systematically applied to uncovering the actual genuine wonders of a natural and social world, can uncork the imagination, the sense of purpose, and the transformative consciousness and initiative of human beings in ways no reference to a presumed higher power ever could. Isn't that an outlook worth striving for?" So in moving toward a conclusion of this section of the talk, I want to talk a little bit more about Lerner and the question of epistemology, and more specifically, religion and what is and is not rational thought. Lerner critiques scientism, But this critique of scientism involves a confusion and mingling of this scientism, which is a kind of positivism, with actual science. At times, Lerner treats science as the reduction of everything to what, as Lerner puts it, can be observed and measured. At other times, he refers to, quote, the tools of science, empirical evidence, and rational thought. And in general, he eclectically combines reductionism and positivism on the one hand with the actual scientific method on the other hand. The scientific method, and this is true most of all of the communist world outlook and methodology, which is a synthesis of materialism and dialectics, and provides the most consistent, systematic, and comprehensive scientific approach to all of reality. This involves not simply empirical evidence, but also qualitative leaps to theory and conceptions, synthesizing facts and observations into a higher level of comprehension of reality. And it involves the testing of hypotheses and theories in practice, in engagement with a larger objective world. This is radically, qualitatively different from scientism and positivism and reductionism, which, as I have spoken to before, are characterized by, among other things, the notion of a linear connection, a more or less direct extension between experience and concepts, instead of what actually happens in reality, where, as Mao pointed out, there are repeatedly qualitative leaps from experience and perceptual knowledge to conceptual or rational knowledge. Rational knowledge, correctly understood, is, well, rational knowledge, which synthesizes what is learned through experience of various kinds, including scientific investigation and experimentation, into an abstraction which reflects reality in a more concentrated and higher way. Lerner wants to argue that religion is no less a mode of rational thought than science. But the truth is that religion is non-rational thought. Among other things, it involves and relies on leaps of faith, which are in opposition to and represent a break or rupture with rational thought, which do not and cannot involve leaps to actually synthesize what is learned through experience of the objective world. And religion puts forward as truths, even as essential and defining truths, things which are not derived from and again cannot in turn be tested in the objective world of material existence. To speak to the non-rational essence of religion is not a matter of hurling insults, but of speaking to the essential reality and nature of religious thinking. And in reality, this non-rational thought that characterizes religion cannot help but lend itself, in one way or another, and to one degree or another, to irrational thinking. From all this, it can be seen more fully that on the one hand, there are important insights in Lerner's Left Hand of God, and there is a significant scope for building unity with Lerner and those who hold similar views. But at the same time, Lerner's worldview and the political orientation and objectives that go along with it cannot lead things where they need to go, even in terms of fully and thoroughly transforming and uprooting the ills in the world and in the relations among people that Lerner points to, sometimes quite incisively, and definitely in terms of uprooting and advancing beyond all relations of exploitation, domination, and oppression, and the culture and ways of thinking that go along with and reinforce them. So I want to stop here now, and then we'll have the last section of this talk.